I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sally Field has been an actress since she was a teenager, playing the boy crazy surfer Gidget in 1965, followed by The Flying Nun. She writes in her frank and moving memoir, In Pieces, that her private and family life were nothing like those early characters she played on TV. She had endured years of sexual abuse by her stepfather, the stuntman Jock Mahoney, and had an abortion right before starring in Gidget. Sally Field has had a successful acting career, winning 2 Oscars, 3 Emmys, 2 Golden Globes, and a Screen Actors Guild Award for playing such memorable and varied roles. I sat down with Sally Field at the Free Library of Philadelphia last week before a sold-out audience of her fans and talked with her about how the character she has played, the therapy she has gotten, and even writing her book has helped her better understand herself. The interview began with a standing ovation. Good evening. It's great to share the stage with Sally Field.
Thank you, Marty.
Does that ever get old, standing ovations?
No.
I read your book over the last couple of weekends, and it was so revealing and so intimate, and at times I laughed out loud, at times I cried, and I felt as if it was a memoir written by a private person who just left everything on the page. And I know it took about 7 years or so to write. It's been out for a year. Did you write it for you? Did you write it for us?
My mother passed away when I was 65, on my very birthday. And I'm just turning 73 next week. So
right.
It's been a little while. And when my mother passed away, I thought I had done all the things that we know we should do, those conversations, the bumps in the road to sort of solve them and hold each other and let nature do what it does, and you let your older parent die and you keep going with your life. I had done all of that. But when she was gone, I felt deeply disquieted. There was something festering inside me, a thorn, a sliver I hadn't seen, and I didn't know where it was. I didn't know what it was. And about the same time as that, very serendipitously, a good friend of mine who is the co-founder of the Omega Institute in upstate New York, every year they would do a long weekend called Women in Power, and they would invite the most extraordinary women on earth to speak. And my friend Elizabeth this year, that when my mother passed away, she called and she said, "Are you coming?" And I said, "Absolutely. I need to be there and sit in the back of the room the way I usually do and just listen to everybody." And she said, "Well, I'm so glad you'll be there because I want you to give the keynote address."
Don't you love that?
And I said, I can't possibly do that. I can't do that. Elizabeth, don't ask me to do that. How dare you ask me to do that? I can't do that. I said, I have nothing to say. And she said, "Yes, you do." And I knew she was right. I had something to say, not for them, for me. And I had to write it down, and I had to say it. And what I felt from this room, this dark space of these people that could be you, listening and taking what I was saying from them to me, from me to them, I knew that I had to write it down, the whole story, and that was the beginning of it. And ultimately, that speech in some form turned into the last chapter of the book. I didn't have anybody to help me. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew I had to learn a new craft to go into the boxes of memorabilia that I had, the letters that I had kept that I had never read because I didn't have the courage to read them. I didn't want to know about myself. I didn't want to know about my life. And most especially, I didn't want to know about my mother. And I had to do it because I would never rest. I would never feel joined with her and let her go until I knew what it was I was missing.
It's a profound story in so many ways, and the title is In Pieces. And as you write, and as you just said,
there were pieces of yourself that you had just cut off. And there are so many ways that you describe not knowing parts of yourself or not recognizing or being in a situation and putting a part of yourself somewhere else where you wouldn't have to deal with it in pieces.
Yes. I think because I come from a childhood of trauma, and I think I have learned subsequently, and as I learned through my life, oddly enough, I learned it by playing some of the characters that I had the opportunity to play, that trauma separates you in sometimes, in most cases. And I learned to survive because when things were very traumatic with my stepfather, I would send the part of me that felt traumatized, that felt frightened and angry and like I wanted to run, I would send it outside to be with the tree that I could see out of the window so that part of me could stay alive and doing the things I had to do to have this man love me. And that separation of myself with other pieces, valuable pieces of myself, took a long time to piece together. And being an actor, being able to work finally in learning the craft with a great teacher who was Lee Strasberg. While I thought I was learning to become an actor, in reality, I was learning to put the pieces of myself back together. And I was fortunate enough to be cast in characters at the right time that was oddly similar to what I was needing to find in myself. And when I really committed to those characters, be they Sybil or Norma Rae and others, it was an act of uniting with me. And that's a part of being in pieces.
I do want to get to all those three characters, but you talk about your stepfather, Jack Mahoney. He was a stuntman. And what really struck me was in the family, in many ways, you were the favored child over your brother, for instance. And he lavished you with attention, but it came with this terrible price. And being a little girl and being both around this very charismatic man, but he wanted something of you that he should never have had.
Yes.
He was sexually abusing you.
Yes, yes, yes. Certainly it's I've spent my life trying to organize that piece of information in my head. Yeah. And how it doesn't run my life or rule my life, that you have an abusive parent that you also adore. So how does a child fit all of those pieces in place? I was, because of that information, what this little girl was learning in the 50s and then 60s is information about what loving is. If I love this man who makes me feel alive because he's paying me attention, and yet I have to do things that make me feel that I want to crawl out of my skin and I feel frightened and I'm in danger, it taught me that love and danger go together. There's a saying, you know, in psychological terms, is what's fired together is wired together. Mm-hmm. When the synapses of your brain, when those emotions as a child, because I knew him from the time I was not quite four, that I was taught that to feel love, you also have to feel danger. You have to feel there's a threat around. Because that's the information that was given to me as a child. And certainly I've spent my life trying to detangle that message.
As you say, in many ways, this book is about your mother, your relationship with her. She came from really an extraordinary, very matriarchal family. Margaret was her name. She looked absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. But she must have known what was going on with you and your stepfather.
I mean, that's certainly the question I ask throughout the book. I don't know that she did. I don't know. Eventually, at the end, and I don't want to spoil the ending, for Lord's sakes.
It's a powerful
I live.
Ending.
I just want to let you know. I don't die in the end. But for me, the one of the key things is as she was passing away, and I finally realized that I had to go find someone to help me because she was passing away in my house. She was losing weight, and her death was imminent, and you could see it happening. And I felt like I was dying. I was dying. I couldn't breathe. Something was happening to me. And that was when I reached out and found a wonderful therapist. And he was the first doctor that was really able to say to me very clearly that I was in pieces. Mm. And it was part of my problem of why I felt so scattered. But he was also instrumental in saying to me, I needed to talk to her. Finally, and even though I felt she must know, surely she know, and I had thought I had had that, didn't I have that conversation? Wasn't that conversation done? I had it. I must have had it. But she and I were doing the same thing, pretending we had had conversations that we'd never had, hearing them in our heads and never saying the words. And words matter. Name it to tame it. There's another slogan. Name it to tame it. I had to say, she looked like a little newborn bird. She was so fragile and frail. And I had to say, this was my life, Mom. This was my childhood. Where were you? Where were you? And see her reaction. And it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary. And I thank God that we had that conversation, even though it took me writing the whole book and the whole 7 years to understand really what I had gained from it.
There's a great scene. In fact, you begin the book, you're in grade school, you're in a play, and you have one line, drop dead, Harry. And you write, a new sensation had brushed past me, and for one moment, I felt free. I mean, that was being on the stage. Mm-hmm. As a young actor.
Yes. I had a drama department in the seventh grade. I was 12, and I found a stage. And I so lived in a fog bank. I could barely see anything because I understand that's another thing that happens to children of trauma, is that they put themselves in a kind of white world that I could perceive the things I needed to perceive, but not very much more. I couldn't read a book. I couldn't do a book report. I couldn't make my brain work that way because a survival mechanism had made it so I wasn't allowed to see certain things. And part of my brain was keeping me alive. But I could memorize a poem, and I could memorize a play. And I could do that. And when I did, I was alive and I was free. And not because I was this other character, it was because I was me. Finally, I was me. And I could walk across the stage at 12 and not know where to put my hands, and my pits were dripping so much I was making a puddle.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
But for tiny flashes of light, I was alive. And I've always said that I spent the rest of my life chasing the fireflies on the edges of my eyes. I was alive when I could get into those moments. I wasn't lost in the white bank of denial or whatever it was that was trying to keep me alive. I wasn't trying to please anybody or do what they wanted or what they didn't want. I was alive. Like it or not, this is me, folks.
Well, that's what I think is so... What's so fascinating about acting, which is it's not acting. Acting is not acting. It's being yourself. But it's finding that person, right?
It was to me, and I think more actors than you're aware of, they always talk about acting as that it's people who want to hide behind somebody else. And I think really, you know, actors who are skilled, it is quite the opposite. It is revealing aspects of yourself, deeply intimate, personal aspects of yourself. It is a storytelling device. I reveal myself through another character, yes, through somebody else's words, yes, but it's me. The emotion, the reality, the intimacy, the now of it is me. And it is why stage or even why film is compelling, like why one actor is more compelling than another, because they're able to reach something inside of themselves that communicates and we feel not as alone. You as an audience, me as a performer, I'm not alone for this 1 second. Hmm. I'm connected to this, you, this.
So were you Gidget?
Oh, gosh, yes. I was. Gidget happened, you know, when I had just graduated from high school. I literally was discovered on a street corner, but so oddly, weirdly serendipitous that some fate thing was looking out for me. My family was in a bit of disarray, and I was in that fog bank. I couldn't think of it. I didn't know. And so I had nothing to do. I had no stage, so how would I live? I went to a workshop that my stepfather had found, so clearly had not much to do with acting, but it was located at a studio, at Columbia Studios, that was the old, when they used to have a really old studio system. And I had to audition to get into the workshop. I got into the workshop and I was there for the first night, using a sound stage at Old Columbia Studios. And I was standing on a street corner waiting for my brother to pick me up because I wasn't allowed to drive at night. I was 17, and a casting man came out and asked me if I wanted to come on a meeting the next day.
Wow.
And I met all that summer I graduated from high school, and it was for a television series called Gidget. So it was just right out of the, you know, shoot, and there I was. But as disconnected as I was from so much of myself, I was Gidget. That was the part of me that I could harness and use. It was the part that was acceptable. She was the girl next door. She was sweet and nice, and butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. And I was all those things, and yet I was a whole lot of other things.
You see before you me, Gidget. For 15 and a half years, my life was a complete and total ick. But then, on the 23rd of June, two things happened. I fell in love with two things. Jeff, my moon doggy, and surfing. I am happy to report that falling in love was as easy and natural as learning how to surf. From the moment we met, we knew we were meant for each other.
It was perfect for that time, and I got to live in this pink and yellow world, and I had a father who was caring and loving, and I got to learn about this craft, the beginnings of learning about a craft that I would spend my entire existence in.
More from Sally Field after this short break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to an interview I recorded with actress Sally Field at the Free Library of Philadelphia before a sold-out audience last week. Her memoir, In Pieces, is out in paperback. It's about how she had to wall off parts of herself in order to survive sexual abuse by her stepfather and how acting and therapy helped her put herself back together. We left off talking about playing Gidget.
Well, it seems the opposite of Gidget has to be Sybil. But you also say you knew her when you, I guess, read the part or read for the part. It's like you knew who Sybil was. Is that because you shared the kind of dissociation that she had?
Sybil, when I read, I knew this. I knew this person. I knew this belonged to me. And if I had to literally throw myself in front of everyone as they're driving out in their cars and say, run me down, kill me, but I'm going to do this role. And I I practically had to do that. But I did get the role, and it was mine. It did belong to me, and it taught me, because she was very similar to me. I mean, certainly more extreme, but it was a territory that I didn't know I knew until I played it.
Well, it's an extraordinary performance. I watched some of it again in preparation for tonight's interview. And one of the things that you write in your book, some part of me knew something the rest of me didn't know. And that was so true for Sybil, and part of her being in pieces was her psychiatrist trying to put all those pieces together. But there was a scene, you're in a hotel room, and you're out of your mind, and we watch you know, switch from one character to another, all obviously Sybil.
Yeah.
Even though there were different names and different stories. Fascinating, though, to watch you do that. And exhausting.
What kicked it off this time?
I lost my job, and I tried to ask
Yeah, you asked your father about seeing me. What happened? What did he say? Sybil?
The people, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. No, you keep them away from me. I will do it.
He doesn't care. Sybil?
I hate Sybil. I hate her.
Who are you?
I can do anything I want to. I can do anything. I can walk on her chair if I take my shoes off like that and like that and like that. And I can walk on the chair like that and like that and like that. And you can stop me.
At that time, when Sybil came out, no one had ever really talked about child abuse. It just wasn't anything anybody talked about. And there had been some films that sort of hinted on it, but not really. My co-star in it, the brilliant and extraordinary Joanne Woodward, had been in a film called Three Faces of Eve. But even within that, they shied away from what had caused her mental health issues. And they said it was because she wouldn't kiss her dead grandmother. But in reality, it was abuse. That is what causes this in most cases, a trauma, not just a one little incident. It is a repeated traumatic behavior that a child creates a device inside their head to survive. And when this happened, and it does talk about child abuse, sexual abuse, even though it is not really sexual, but yes, it is, and it was so monstrous what it felt like when it happened. People would stop me on the street, and I remember one time literally somebody stopped their car and jumped out and they in the middle of the street, not to because they wanted an autograph, or it was because they wanted to thank me and because they wanted to tell me that they knew this, they understood this. And the letters that came in from doctors, and it's still to this day shown in, I think, psychology classes in college. It's psych one. It's not like advanced, but but it was a huge change in the dialogue in the country to really talk about the damage of child abuse, what it does to that little soul, and how hard it is to recover.
Were you conscious of that when you were playing Sybil? I mean, thinking that this was a part of your life or something that you could play to help you understand your childhood?
I stayed distant and distanced from this information for myself for so long, even though part of me knew, because I could feel it as an actor. I could feel it as a person. I could feel myself changing gears. And I would just call it something else, but I could feel myself pulling parts of me in as if they were floating on the outside of me, literally trying to pull them in to be with me. And it wasn't until literally I'm in my 60s working with Dan Siegel. And he said to me one day, he said, when we were newly working together, and I'm trying to figure out why I can't breathe. My mother's the one that's dying. Why does it feel like it's me? And he just calmly said one day, can you name all the aspects of yourself? I said, what? Name all of the, he didn't call them pieces, I did. He said, can you name all of the characters that you are? And I said, yeah. And I just named them all. I had names for them without even knowing that I had them. And again, it's like name it, you tame it. It was information I always had, but it wasn't until he made me really verbalize it. And then literally gave me the task of talking to each of them.
You talked about, you write about being in the actor's studio, Lee Strasberg, who you mentioned, and he said to, I guess, all of his actors, get into therapy. I mean, he thought that therapy was a really good thing for an actor to do. Maybe to put those pieces together or just
well,
understand
yourself?
Well,
I think it's because
yourself.
He always said, you know, what we actors, all you have to use is this. He always felt that as much information as you can have about your own triggers, your own life, your own history, only then can you both use it and walk away from it. Without that, without really understanding your own emotional process and your own limitations, where you feel yourself to start to shut down as a person, it's going to get in your way as an actor. And you have to be free of all of those things, or at least understand them.
How about Norma Rae, which was, I think, another one of these characters, as you mentioned, and as you write in your book, that you sort of use to help understand yourself, and she does literally find her voice.
Yes. By the time I got to know, it took me certainly a long time, which felt like an enormous journey to get to Norma, and it was so oddly, again, the right role at the right time for me. And her standing up for her dignity was really me standing up for mine. But I didn't know it. I didn't know it at the time. And Norma was the only film. Norma was actually the first film I ever starred in, you know, where I was the star of the film. And it was the only role that at that time that I certainly desperately wanted that I didn't have to throw myself in front of the moving train to get. Because Marty Ritt, the extraordinary director who then became so important to me, a mentor, and if I had a father figure, it certainly was Marty. He taught me so much about everything. And he said to me, he said, we've offered this film to four or five other actors, actresses, and they turned it down, and I've always wanted you to do it. I think you can do it. And I said, okay. He said, no one else wants you. But that's always been the case. He said, no one else wants you. The studio doesn't want you. But I do. And if you want to do this, I will fight for you and I will win. And he did. And then I was Norma.
Yeah.
I want you to put it in writing. The chair of Lamar Miller. It's going to take Norma Rae Webster straight home, and I want you to sign it, and I want you to hand it to me.
Don't you tell me what to do, young lady. You're getting nothing from me in writing. So, Mason, you want her off the premises. Take her out. I don't know if I want to get in the same car with you and nobody else.
Lamar. I ain't gonna bite you.
Part of the great worth of and gift of being an actor is that you're asked to be in somebody else's shoes and to know them and become them as much as you can and to live in other places that you would never live. So to do Norma Rae and living in Opelika, Alabama, and working in the mill, in this old mill, and understanding what that life is like, it was an extraordinary gift. It changes who you are.
Let me jump ahead to Mary Todd Lincoln. Steven Spielberg obviously directing you in that. And Daniel Day-Lewis wanted you as well.
This was, oddly enough, exactly when my mother was dying, exactly when I went to see Dan Siegel because I thought I was drowning, exactly when I started to put the pieces of me back together, exactly when Dan was giving me the information that I had to talk to my mother. And as I started to emerge in this, I realized I couldn't listen to the side of me that said this was never going to be. Mary was mine, and it had to be mine. And I rose up, and Stephen called me and said, Sal, I've owed you a call, but you know what? Now that we have Daniel, I just really, really don't see the two of you together. And I said, Stephen, you're wrong. I said, this is mine, and you're wrong. I said, Stephen, look, I know that I have a lot of baggage and that you would rather have someone who the audience can look at and have no connection to other than Mary. And by then, I had been doing what I was doing for, 40-some-odd years. Now it's 50-some-odd years. And I said, even so, Stephen, the audience will let that go if you let me do the work that I can do. And he said, I don't know. I knew that it was also that I'm 10 years older than Daniel, and Mary was 10 years younger than Lincoln. I said, Stephen, test me. So he tested me, but he said, Daniel can't come. Daniel's in Ireland. He's in a cocoon. He's becoming Lincoln. He's hanging upside down. And I said, well, all right, but I'll do it alone. I'll do it alone. Give me some hair and makeup and the thing and the clothes, and I'll do it, for goodness sakes. So we did it in like a room, like an empty stage like this. I did alone and just talked to the wall. And Stephen called me the next day and said, Sal, I'm so sorry.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Together with old footage of Daniel, and I just don't see this as working. And I said, oh, Stephen, thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for letting me fight for it. I really appreciate it. And I hung up the phone and wanted to kill myself. And like days and days and days went by. And then I get a phone call from Stephen, his assistant, and say, well, we just want to know, do you want the same hair and makeup people? And I said, for what, a cup of tea? I said, oh, no, did we not tell you?
Oh, my gosh.
What? Well, Daniel is flying into L.A. because he thinks that Stephen needs to see the two of you together on film. So Daniel flew in. And we were in separate places, becoming an early version of Mary and an early version of Mr. President. And we met in this sort of magical moment as Mary and Mr. Lincoln. And I saw him coming across like the lobby as I was sitting in a chair with a sort of shaft of sunlight coming on me. I thought, don't move, Sally, this is perfect. Don't move. And he came across the room with his hat and his loping kind of thing. And I waited till he was right next to me. And I stood up and gave him my hand. And he kissed it. And he said, Molly, that's what Lincoln called Mary. And I said, Mr. President, that's what she called him when he got to be president. And he kissed my hand. And then I put my face in his chest. Mind you, I hadn't even met the man. Hello. I put my face in his chest, and I said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he kissed the top of my head and said, my honor.
Wow. Wow.
And that was the beginning of our relationship.
Lucky you.
Mrs. Lincoln.
Madam President, if you please. Oh. Don't convene another subcommittee to investigate me, sir. I'm teasing. Smile, Senator Wade.
I believe I am smiling, Mrs. Lincoln.
As long as you household accounts are in order, madam. we'll have no need to investigate them.
You have always taken such a lively, even prosecutorial interest in my household accounts.
Your household accounts have always been so interesting.
Yes, thank you. It's true. The miracles I have wrought out of fertilizer bills and cutlery invoices, but I had to.
That was Sally Field playing Mary Todd Lincoln, for which she got an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. Her memoir, In Pieces, is out in paperback. She's in Philadelphia filming Dispatches from Elsewhere for AMC. Thanks to Andy Cahan and the Free Library of Philadelphia for their assistance on this interview. Special thanks to WHYY engineer Charlie Kyer for his surgical skills. Diana Martinez is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. John edited this interview. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening.